All right. Today we are going to finish up Judges. We're in the 17th chapter and the 18th chapter of Judges. And then next week and the rest of this quarter, we'll look at Ruth. And then we'll finish up this book, and then we'll move back in to the New Testament for our next quarter. So, today's lesson is called The Domino Effect. You know, when you set up a stack of dominoes on the table and you hit them, you hit one on the end, what happens? They all go down. You know, you've seen those fancy things that people do and make they just travel and go up hills and down hills and everything. What if you had a stack of dominoes and you started it, but right in the middle you had the Bible in your hand and you put it right in the middle before it got to that next domino? What would happen? It would stop. So let's think about that as we think about the title of the lesson and what this lesson is about. It's probably going to be about somebody that, in all likelihood, you and I don't recall ever having studied about this gentleman. Now, his name is very familiar to us. His name is Micah, but he is not the Micah that we know as the prophet. It's just another gentleman that happened to have his name. These things that I've got listed on the board today: drugs, alcohol, sports, magazines, possessions, anything that you might really be proud of, money, shopping, food. I spoke to Carol on a couple of those. Food, favorite TV shows that you got to watch, can't miss, record if you're going to be gone. Movie stars, in this case, the last couple of weeks, maybe an Olympic star. What are these? What can these things become?
Idols.
So we're not the only ones. They're not the only ones that had idols that they worshiped. We worship them sometimes and don't quite even realize that we're doing it. So the statement in my book said, "It's my life. Why should anyone else be concerned about how I choose to live?" So we're going to look at Judges chapter. It goes through 17 through 21, and it finishes out the book of Judges. And every week I ask you, please read your background passages, because it always makes a difference to keep you up, and it doesn't feel like you're just jumping around from verse to verse. Nobody sins in a vacuum. What does that mean? No one sins in a vacuum.
If you're all to yourself, you're enclosed. So if you're in a vacuum, nobody can get to you, so therefore you can't sin.
No.
The devil can't get to you.
Yeah. Well, but this says nobody sins in a vacuum. Nobody sins in a vacuum. That means that when you sin, it's not just on you.
Sin.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to ask you what you thought I said.
I'm sinning.
Oh, sin. Oh, no. Okay. Nobody sins in a vacuum, meaning that when you sin, it kind of filters and falls downhill, goes, spreads out, just like Zeta said. Yep. I mean, our wrong attitudes and our actions do affect others. We may never realize the extent or the effect of the sins that we commit, how they affect other people around us, and even future generations of our families. God wants us, we're His people, to avoid setting in motion the multiplying effects of sin. He wants us to live by godly standards, so the good we do will be seen in the generations to come. So setting a good example is the bottom line. To your children, your grandchildren, your workplace, wherever you are. But most importantly, your family, because that's what you're going to affect probably the most. The final five chapters of Judges that we're studying this week do not mention a judge. So guess what? They're just willy-nilly free to do what they want.
Whatever feels good,
that's what they were doing. Instead, it shows us the depravity of Israel and how if they didn't have a leader, they were just... And you know, I've been thinking about this too. You kind of tend to think about that the people that we call the people of Israel, all the way back to the trip through the desert, the 40 years of traveling, and all the way up to this now. It's different generations of people. You kind of tend to want to think it's the same people making the same mistakes over and over again. And it's not. Now we know that it's not the originals, but you do tend to forget and think about that it's generation to generation, and some of them have known nothing but the 40 years in the desert. And then they get the promised land, and then they don't have anybody really leading them, and they get crazy. So that's where we're at. So this all resulted because of the people refusing to worship God and obey His commands, to just do it on their own and do the right thing. They just could not do it because they didn't have somebody holding them in check. So let's look at the first verses in chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. It's called Disintegration of a Family. There was a man named Micah who lived in the hill country of Ephraim. One day he said to his mother, "I heard you place a curse on the person who stole 1,100 pieces of silver from you. Well, I have the money. I was the one who took it." "The Lord bless you for admitting it," his mother replied. He returned the money to her, and she said, "I now dedicate these silver coins to the Lord. In honor of my son, I will have an image carved and an idol cast." So when he returned the money to his mother, she took 200 silver coins and gave them to a silversmith who made them into an image and an idol. And these were placed in Micah's house. Micah set up a shrine for the idol, and he made a sacred ephod and some household idols. Then he installed one of his sons as his personal priest. In those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. So they praised the Lord, and she said, the Lord bless you for admitting it. And then she paid some guy 200 pieces of silver to make him an idol in commemoration, I guess. So he's confessing to his mother that he's the one that that took her money. We don't know the motivation or the circumstances behind it or why he took it in the first place. He may have been tormented by his conscience, but verse 2 reveals that more than by his conscience for doing the wrong thing and trying to make things right, he was more worried about that curse that she put on the person that stole it. So both he and his mother were obviously very superstitious people. They had more faith in the power of the curses than in the life of true faith and devotion. They were kind of on the fence, and they could go either way, but they leaned more toward their curses and their superstitions. She says, "My son, you are blessed by the Lord." That's affirmation that her son had done the right thing in returning the money. Is a formal blessing designed to counteract the powers of the curse. And because she truly didn't want her son to be ruined, so she brought the blessing of the Lord, thinking it would cover the curse. His mother's words, "My son, you are blessed by the Lord," also revealed that they worshipped Israel's covenant God and not Baal, the pagan deity. And her son's name, Micah, means "who is like the Lord." So they had God in there somewhere at some point in their lives, in their family life. They followed God, but they mixed it up with superstition. And a lot of people do that today, don't you think? They follow God, but they got this other stuff going on that they think is just as important or needs to kind of run parallel with it. They were more impressed by magical words and objects than with straightforward obedience to God. Just obey Him and do what you're supposed to. Don't take the money in the first place and move on. But he did. He took it. So she goes out. She spends 200 pieces of that 1,100 pieces to make this silver-coated idol. This 200 pieces was 5 pounds of silver. So, and it says the image probably represented some household spirit. Apparently their households had a lot of spirits. And so they had to represent them. And you know, what I was thinking about when I was studying this lesson was they made these idols and then they worshipped them. Well, they made them. You know, they didn't just appear out of nowhere. Or they just, I don't quite get that they, from our perspective, that we don't have things in our house that we bow down and worship. Now, in a sense, we may buy some of these things, and not in the sense that they built a shrine around it. The purpose of the idol was to bring blessings on the home and the people that live there. The practice of displaying images of household gods was common during this time. And they represented different things, and they protected the house and the people that lived there. So, Micah's mother hoped that the household god that she commissioned to be made would be more powerful than the curse that she had placed on the person that stole the silver, not realizing that it was her own son. She might not have been so harsh on the curse if she had realized who had taken her money. So, that's verses 1 through 4. And then a considerable amount of time passes between verses 4 and verses 5. So we pick up that Micah has a shrine, and he is so into this stuff, he thinks he needs a priest. He's got so many idols and so many household gods, he needs a priest. So he makes one of his sons his priest. Now, we all know that's not, you know, even in this time, that's not right. He had so many images that he had in his house, in this shrine, he felt he needed a priest. My commentary said that this all might have taken place years after his mom had made this original silver image that was the end-all, be-all of the images. Micah's family was now thoroughly pagans. Completely and thoroughly pagans. They sought spiritual protection and material prosperity from the power that they felt that these religious images had. The people of Israel were in covenant with the Lord, but there was no king in Israel in the last chapters of Judges. So guess what they did, just like Lee said, whatever they wanted to do. They missed out on the blessings of God and the guidance of God because they repeatedly, over and over and over again, backslid. They served other gods, and they just went down, spiraled down into chaos, just moral chaos. They were probably a mirror image of Sodom and Gomorrah almost. They were so bad. So, when we were earlier talking about how we don't sin in a vacuum, that it flows downhill, especially in our family. So Micah's mom, generation, Micah, generation, Micah's son, who he made a priest, who's not a priest, and made him pagan. So there's a pattern that where it's Micah's sin started it, but then the mama contributed to it because she made the idol. Then Micah contributed to it even more because he got his son involved. So what if Micah's mom had not turned him toward evil? What if she'd just said, the blessing of the Lord be upon you, and let's just try to do the right thing, and we're going to move forward, and we're going to worship God, and we're going to thank Him that you saw the error of your ways, and we're going to move on. We wouldn't have had this story as part of the Bible, probably. It might have had a different ending, that's for sure. So let's look at corruption of a high calling. It's still in chapter 17, verses 7 and 8. It says, one day, a young Levite who had been living in Bethlehem in Judah arrived in that area. He had left Bethlehem in search of another place to live, and as he traveled, he came to the hill country of Ephraim. He happened to stop at Micah's house as he was traveling through. And then verses 12 through 13. Said, so Micah installed the Levite as his personal priest, and he lived in Micah's house. I know the Lord will bless me now, Micah said, because I have a Levite serving as my priest. Because we all know that priests came from the line of Levite. If you were a priest, you had to be a Levite, because God set him aside to do just that. So, he was described as living in the territory of Judah. So that meant that he was not from the family of Aaron. And we all know Aaron was Moses' brother, and he was the set aside the Levites to be the priest. Priests who were descendants of Aaron resided and served at the main worship center of Israel. Other Levites, not belonging to the family of Aaron, lived in locations scattered out through the Promised Land, and they served as sort of like local clergy. The descendants of Aaron were the priest, and only the descendants of Aaron were the Levite priests who officiated at the tabernacle and then at the temple after King Solomon built it. So they were the ones that did all the officiating. All the official things that happened at the tabernacle and the temple. There were other Levite clans that my commentary mentions. There were two Gershonite clans, four Kohathite clans, and two Merariite clans. And if you look in Numbers 3, we won't go there, but if you look in Numbers 3, verses 21 through 37, that's where you find out what and who those clans were. They were Levites, but they weren't of the family of Aaron. They did non-priestly duties, things that had to be done with regard to the tabernacle and the temple, but they were non-priestly duties. They took care of the tent. They made sure the tent stayed in good shape. They took care of the pegs that they pegged them down with. Somebody's got to do all that. They were the maintenance guys. They took care of the furnishings inside the tabernacle or the temple, and all the sacred objects. That was their job, to make sure that they were taken care of. But they had to be Levite, because you remember God said you had to be a Levite and you'd be struck dead if you weren't and you touched anything you weren't supposed to touch. So when the temple was built by King Solomon, they assisted the priests, but they did not serve as priests themselves. So this is this guy that's come into the picture. So this Levite in our verse, he had traveled a long way to find a new home. Why he was looking for a new home, we don't know. We don't know his name either, and we won't know his name. But my commentary said that he traveled way, way, way north of where he lived to end up where Micah lives. And I guess he felt like that he never would make very much money doing what he was doing before, so he felt like he needed to go find another job. So
the book said that he was hunting for a place where he could make more money.
Make more money. That's right. That's right. Because he didn't want to be just the taker care of things person. He wanted to do other things. Micah knew that it was wrong for his son to be a priest. But see, that's another thing. He knew it, but he did it. He knew it was wrong to steal his mama's money, but he did it. He knew it was wrong to have those idols, but they did it. They know it, but they're still doing it. That's the way sin is. You know you're doing it, but you just get so caught up in it, you still do it. So he offers this guy just falls in his lap. He's a Levite. He can officially be a priest. So he offers him a job. 10 pieces of silver a year. Now his mama spent 200 pieces to make this idol. And he's going to offer this guy 10 pieces of silver a year, one change of clothes and food and a place to stay. So this was exactly what the guy was looking for, I guess. So he took the job, and he lived in Micah's house with him, and he took over the priestly duties. But now he's not really being a priest. He's minding the shrine with all these idols. So he's not God's priest, that's for sure. So they were Micah's family, with all this silver flowing around, were obviously wealthy. So Micah had built up, his mama spent all that money for the idol. He built up a shrine that was so large it needed a priest to take care of it. The Old Testament never endorses the idea of having a priest serve a single household. They were meant to serve communities of people, not an individual and not just one family. So Micah still recognized the Lord as God, even though he had just gone over to the pagan side, but he believed he could obtain God's favor by having this Levite installed as a priest. So that tells you, to me, that Micah, he knew the error of his ways, and this was just one thing he was trying to do to make himself look good in front of God. So Micah's idea of true religion was far from the biblical teaching of walking humbly with God and looking after widows and orphans. Walking humbly with God and looking after widows and orphans. And he was so far from that. So far. So let's look at degeneration of an entire society. We're going to skip over to chapter 18. And we're going to look at verses 30 and 31. It says, then they set up the carved image and they appointed Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses, as their priest. This family continued as priests for the tribe of Dan until the exile. So Micah's carved image was worshipped by the tribe of Dan as long as the tabernacle of God remained at Shiloh. So, these verses tell us about the tribe of Dan. If you want to, later this week, Joshua 19, verses 40 through 48, they tell us about the tribe of Dan. And they were given an allotment when God brought them into the promised land. They were given their allotment of territory. But they were never able, you know how he split it all up and he said, you're going to go here and you're going to have this and you're going to have that. They were never able to take possession of the land that God had given them. They had failed. So they went out looking for somewhere new. And they sent 5 scouts out to look for a new place to settle. And they came to Micah's house and they saw the Levite priest. So they decided this was a good spot. Everybody seemed to be having a good time and everybody seemed to be pretty, things plentiful, food was plentiful. So they went back and told them about Micah's place and that territory and how great it was. And it says their migration from bad to worst spiraled into violence and superstition. They disregarded the hospitality of Micah. He tried to offer them hospitality in our preceding verses of 19. They robbed Micah of his idols. And in taking the idols, the tribe of Dan showed they too had become pagan in their thinking. And I think the reason that they weren't ever able to possess the land that God had given them was because they weren't asking God to help them. They were trying to do it on their own, so they failed. The Levite participated in the theft and went with the tribe of Dan. They hired him away from Micah. He probably saw the writing on the wall. There was like 600 of them and one of Micah. And he figured he could make more money because there's more people. So all he wanted was a bigger congregation and a bigger paycheck. So the Danites threatened Micah with death if he tried to take back his idols. They kill the people in the town that had not been given to them, and then arrogantly renamed it Dan after they finished. They set up Micah's images and idols, and they worshiped them. So they were illegitimate and evil from their very beginning in this new town that they had taken. It had been founded with stolen property, and they were served by a faithless, nameless Levite. In the end, the shrine of Dan helped bring about the downfall of an entire nation and send its people into exile. So how can we apply this lesson? This was another one that I thought in this series of Judges that I thought was kind of interesting and hard to wrap around our minds with something that could apply to us. So how can we apply this lesson?
Let our behavior bring other people down.
That's right. Because if we do it, our kids are going to do it. Their kids are going to do it. And eventually they're not going to remember why they do it. They just do it. That's like alcohol and drug. Alcohol particularly. Yes, ma'am.
I know a family that has two boys. One of them works hard. The other one has gotten messed up with drugs. Been involved in drugs. And just don't learn from his mistakes. And he's about to separate his mama. The whole family about to apart, basically.
Yeah. See, and if he doesn't change, then it'll just spiral down. So never let your behavior become a reason to a family member to be led astray. Well, it's okay because Betty does it, so why can't I do it? Be a consistent example of godly behavior so that those who know and watch you will be encouraged to live for God. You know, because we're watched even by those we don't know. Those we affect are most likely the people in our closest circle, family and friends, but strangers too. Because if they see you as a believer and they see you doing something, they're going to think, well, if that believer can do it, then I'll be a believer if I can do that. Does anybody have anything they want to add?
The people around you see everything you do, but God knows everything.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Nothing at all. And people forget that so easily.